Hi, my name's June and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I really want to thank the committee and all of you for giving me the chance to be here. I love so many people in this room, and there are so many people in Florida that have touched my life, and a lot of them are here tonight, and they've been here this weekend, and I just feel so honored to be able to be here. I couldn't help but think, as I've listened to the speakers this weekend, you know, about one of my favorite things about Alcoholics Anonymous, which is that we are people who normally would not mix. And if you've heard the different meetings that I have heard, I don't think you could fail to agree, you know, with that statement as you hear the different places. And that is what is so amazing, I think, one of the many things, but certainly one of my favorite things that strikes me about Alcoholics Anonymous. I am here too. You know, there are some of my heroes that are sharing with you guys this weekend. And, you know, the idea that Bob and Sandy were going to be here this weekend had a lot to do with my being able to be here. I think that, you know, when you have been able to be sober for a while, it's still so important, those people that have gone ahead of me and the things that they have shared about over the years, and their sense of humor and their stories have done so much for me over the years. And it was just so special when I got the program and saw that those guys were going to be here. I got to come to Florida to the state conference in 1981, and it was at the Breakers Hotel, and I met some of the friends that matter the most to me 25 years ago, you know, there, and there's a lot of them here, you know, Howie and Patty and the Star Brothers, and, you know, just a lot of folk. Shipwreck, you know, and, well, you just got to know Shipwreck, you know. And I just, you know, I felt really nostalgic about being here. When I got to that conference, there was a guy there, and because I am really a person who has been greatly affected by the stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a guy who also spoke at that conference in 1981, and his name was John Vicar. And I had the privilege of spending the weekend, you know, with John, and he was one of the most amazing people, you know, I ever got to know. And you know, one of the things that John talked about was John had gotten sober on Skid Row, and he lived on Skid Row until he was 7 years sober. And even at that point, he was several weeks behind in his rent on Skid Row, you know, in sobriety. And he shared about the guy that became his sponsor when he was on Skid Row, someone that he had drank with and that he had known in the bars. And this guy used to pick him up to take him to meetings. And this guy was married, and he had a family. And this guy would pick up John to take him to meetings, and he would bring a paper bag lunch. And on the way to the meeting, he'd say, "Hey, John, say my wife made me this dinner, and I can't eat it all." He said, "But if maybe you could help me eat a half a sandwich, it would really help me out so I wouldn't, you know, hurt her feelings when I get home." And he said, John would tell me he was many years sober before he realized, you know, this guy ate dinner with his family at the table every night before he ever went, you know, but he knew that someone like John would never have taken a sandwich if it had been just offered to him, you know. And I thought so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous have tricked me or touched my life. And I'm so grateful for that. I'm going to go ahead and start off with some of the things that I like to always try and remember to say. I want to welcome any of you who are new or might be visiting Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you to know that I am not an authority on alcoholism, on Alcoholics Anonymous, or on anything else that I might talk about tonight, certainly. And in case you are new or visiting, I want you to know something that's really important. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't have any dues or fees. And If this was about money, I wouldn't be here. When I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any money, and I was well over 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I could afford to put a dollar in the basket. You know, and I want you to know that because so many people these days come into Alcoholics Anonymous in so many different ways, and I certainly don't think it matters. Some of them come in through jails and institutions. Some of them come in through treatment centers and things like that. But it seems like every once in a while I wonder and worry that it gets a little murky, depending on how you come through, that you might think there's some money involved, and that's not what this is about. I also want you to know that no one is paid for any of the work or service, you know, that they do in talking in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or making coffee or things like that. And I want you to know that, you know, for a couple of reasons. Again, because Alcoholics Anonymous is free. And then also afterwards when you're judging my talk, you know, you don't have to sit around thinking, you know, we had to pay her for that, you know. So I like to start out, you know, by saying that sort of thing. I am a person tonight that I never would have wanted to be. And I live a life today that I never would have wanted any part of. And yet I have a better life than I ever could have imagined. I most of the time, I wouldn't trade places with anyone. And boy, that was a long time coming in Alcoholics Anonymous and certainly before. I talked at a meeting, it's been a number of years ago now, and back in my area, back in Los Angeles area, and afterwards this guy came over to thank me for talking, mostly because his sponsor was standing behind him. And he said, you know, I want to thank you for your talk. He said, I thought that was a good story. He said, I don't really believe it was your story, but I liked the way you told it. And I thought, you know, it's only here in Alcoholics Anonymous, really, that we'd be new and we sit there and we think, you know, they're making up these stories, you know, to try and, you know, and they hang around for years until we ask them to tell them, you know. And I thought, thank you, Henry. But what I loved about that is I thought it was such a tribute to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that someone could actually doubt that I came from where I came from and that I lived the way that I lived. Because I got to tell you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked like my story. And I looked like my story for quite a while after being here, you know. I'm one of those people that believes I was born an alcoholic, and I don't want to have a philosophical discussion with any of you about that after the meeting. It's just what I believe. And I believe it because there was something wrong with me before I ever started to drink. And drinking was not my first obsession. Suicide was. And from as far back as I can remember, which is about 5 years old, I began to try and kill myself. And to the best of my knowledge, I really don't think there were any days before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't try and take my own life, put myself in a position where someone else would take my life, or pray to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please let me die. I wanted out. And I know that many of you here tonight did not, you know, start your drinking certainly that way. But this is my story. You know, I never wanted to be me. I never wanted to look like me. I never wanted to be from Venice. I didn't want to have curly hair. I didn't want to live in my alcoholic home. I didn't want to do anything like what was happening in my life. And most of all, I never, for one instant, wanted to feel the way that I was feeling. Life just always hurt way too much. I don't know why. It just always hurt way too much for me from my earliest memory. And I am so grateful that I found drugs when I was 7 years old, and I began to drink on a regular basis when I was 8. By the time I was 9, I found a combination that I never altered in any way, and that was reds or yellows or sleeping pills and alcohol. I never used one without the other because the combined effect of those got me exactly where I needed to go. And I was not a party girl. I was not a social drinker. I don't have any funny, cute stories to tell you, because if you drank the way that I drank, you didn't do much either, you know. I didn't want to feel good. I just wanted to not feel at all. And I am so grateful that it worked that way for me, because I truly believe I would have been locked up in some kind of an institution because I couldn't take it out there. It was just way too painful for me. I grew up in a little beach town in Los Angeles called Venice, and I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I knew a lot about alcoholism firsthand, and there was a lot of violence in my home, and there was a lot of broken promises in my home, and there were a lot of the same kind of things that go on in a lot of the insanity that goes on in an alcoholic home. But I didn't know that it was alcoholism. I just thought my mom was weak, and I would look around, and I became kind of an observer of people. Before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not ever remember seeing a man cry. I've seen men shot, I've seen them stabbed, I've seen them arrested, I've seen their wives leave them, I've seen them their kids overdose. I've seen a lot of things happen in my life. I never saw a man shed a tear under any of those circumstances. And I took that to mean that that was because men didn't feel pain. I looked at the women in my life, and I saw them go through all of those experiences. And some of them didn't break at some of those points, but most of them seemed to have a breaking point for one of those experiences. And I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my whole life trying to be what I thought a man was. And to me, a man was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing with the exception of anger and rage. And if they did, they never let anyone know it. And that was how I tried to live my life, or that was what I wanted, you know, that's how I wanted to live my life. But I'm one of those people that Clancy, I've heard share about, seemed to have been born without any insulation whatsoever for my emotions. So that when I went out there in the world at 5 or 6 and I went to school and I had to deal with them, you know, and these little kids would, you know, tease me about being tall or skinny or having curly hair or, you know, whatever it was, it hurt so much that I felt like I was being cut inside. You know, I mean, it was just unbelievably painful. And I found out something about myself that was the most horrible thing that I could have ever found out about myself. In my book, I found out that I was weak. And I never forgave myself for it. But when I found alcohol and the things that I was to use with it, it was to enable me to not have to be weak anymore, you know, because I didn't feel and I didn't care. I didn't care about you, and I certainly didn't care about me. And growing up, you know, I was raised in a Catholic home, and when I was a little kid, they'd say, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "A boy." And it wasn't as easy back then to do as it is today, you know. But this wasn't a passing fancy. I mean, I really felt quite serious about it, and it began to concern my family, and they started taking me to priests, and then later to psychologists and even psychiatrists, you know, between the cutting the wrists and the overdosing on the baby aspirin and beating my face with a hammer and wanting to be a boy. They thought I had problems. But, you know, I kind of had my first lesson in acceptance, which was to realize that I wasn't going to be able to be a boy, so I had to be the next best thing. And it was sort of like, you know, Bob and Sandy were sharing today about, you know, the way that we picture things or the way that we see it. And the way I saw the world at that time, the only option for me was to be a tough broad. And so I spent all my time before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and some of it afterwards, I might add, trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. And to me, that was someone who cared about no one, you know, who didn't ever show their feelings, who did a lot of fighting, and I did, who was in a gang, and I was. You know, but it's important, you know, rather than just leaving it like that I also give you a little bit more information. You know, I have never won a fight in my life. And, you know, but I've never fought less than 5 people at a time. And my sponsor explained after I'd been sober for a while that, you know, really the reason that I always fought groups of 5 or more is if you fight one person, someone might think you're not a very good fighter. You're not really tough. But if you always fight groups of 5 or more, then they think, you know, maybe she is kind of tough, because why would that many people have had to jump her? You know, so it was sort of that thing, that hope that I had that somebody might convince somebody. And so I walked around a good deal of the time with my mouth beaten up and black eyes and swollen lips and things like that. And I also learned for me that I would much rather you punch me in the face than hurt my feelings. And I just want you to take my word for it. I was very good at getting people to punch me in the face. So anyway, my mom had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years. And my mom was a slipper in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had varying lengths of sobriety. So I knew about AA. I didn't think it worked very well, I guess. I don't know how much I knew about it. I just knew she went to lots of meetings, and I went to lots of them with her. But after I had been out on the streets for a number of years, my mom got sober. And, you know, by the time my mom got sober and brought me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, she didn't bring me because I asked for help. She didn't bring me because I admitted having a problem. She just brought me because she thought if she left me alone, I might get her evicted from another apartment. And I went to that meeting that night, and I did not get sober that night, but the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous began for me. And it began because there was a guy in that meeting that I admired more than anyone else in the world. And I admired him for a lot of reasons that many of you may not identify with, but they were my reasons. Paul was from my neighborhood. He was from Venice. He was actually a drinking friend of my mother's. And I admired Paul because, you know, if I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, really all I wanted was the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens, you know. But Paul, this guy, he was at the meeting that night. He had his knife, you know, he'd ridden his motorcycle. He had his tattoos. He'd just gotten out of jail. And, you know, he drank in the bars with my mom. And I had seen him, you know, if he'd been drinking and he wanted to sit at your table, you just let him have the table. You didn't even talk to him about it because you didn't know what he might do to get the table, you know. And so I looked at this guy, and he had the ability to clear rooms and tables. And I was so impressed that someone like that would be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I thought it was just for weak people like my mom, you know. And I got drunk the next night, and then I came back to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I spent all my time only talking to Paul, because I didn't think anybody else here was really worth talking to. I talked to Paul, and I explained to Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I really was far too young to be an alcoholic, that I had places to go, people to see, things to do. I had my whole life ahead of me. I wasn't anything like my mother, who we all knew was very alcoholic, and so I really was just not alcoholic. And I later learned that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholic, you know. And finally, Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, I'm pretty new in this AA thing. And he said, and they've told me I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. But he said, in your case, I'm going to make an exception. And he said, I've seen the way that you use and drink, and I happen to believe if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you, within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out in the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't making up some story, you know, about something that I didn't know about. He was talking about things that were happening and beginning to happen in my life. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to be an alcoholic. You know, by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the only person that I hated more than my mother, who I had blamed for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life, and take it from me, a lot had gone wrong. The only person I hated more than her was me. You know, and I just couldn't even imagine coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it, you know, and then not even being able to drink. I mean, it's just how bad could it get, you know? But the thing was is that I wasn't able to shut off the feelings anymore, you know? By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not have gone on breathing in and out three more times, hating myself any more than I did. It's just not possible. I couldn't go any farther down, you know? And I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I raised my hand. And I know today that there were people at that meeting who did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. In particular, the third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason I know that they did not know about that tradition is because when I raised my hand, some of the people knew who I was because my mother had been in and out of AA for so many years, and they knew how old I was, and they came over to me and they told me that AA was for grown-ups, and they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meetings while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back, they'd get together and ask me to leave. And I just thought AA didn't want me either. I didn't know that there was a third tradition that said no one can throw anybody out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous if they have a desire to stop drinking. I just thought they didn't want me either, and I didn't want me either. And I fell back on my number one answer, the answer I'd been using since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's house. I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I went at anyone's house I ever visited. I went in there and I found enough of the kind of pills that I needed to take to kill myself, and I took enough of them to do it one more time. And then I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I got to that meeting, I could not stand or sit. I had to lay in the meeting. And I haven't been to that many meetings in this part of Florida, but where I came into AA in Los Angeles in 1972, they rarely called on people to share who were laying in the meeting, you know. But they did call on me that day, and they were able to tell from whatever I said, which I have no idea, that I needed to be in a hospital. And that was where I came to. And when I came to, the doctor was explaining to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. Now, I cannot tell you exactly why that overdose was any different than all the many other times that I had done that. I just know that it was. Because since that time, one day at a time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. And that was the 13th of July, 1972. I want to let you know, especially if you're new, that I never planned on staying that long. And honestly, if they had given me a choice of whether or not I wanted to go on living that long, I would have checked the no box. I did not stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was afraid that I might go back out there and die. Because I tried to die as long and as hard as I could. I was afraid that if I went back out there, I might be able to continue to live the way that I was living. And I couldn't do it anymore. And that was what kept me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so grateful to the old-timers and the people that were here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I suppose as each one of us feel, I just feel so lucky to have had the home group that I had. The Monday Night Venice group, where it was so important. We learned about the traditions. We were active in general service. We were active in central office. I had the privilege, you know, I was thinking about it when Liz was talking today, of going on real 12-step calls. I mean, wow. You know, I've had the privilege of working on conferences. And by the way, thank you all so much, all of you who worked on it. You really ought to stand up. I think we ought to give you a hand because this is amazing. Come on, stand up for a minute. And I strongly encourage you, if you are new or relatively new, that you get involved in some area of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I consider it one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, and I can't even begin to tell you what it has meant in my life. I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've already mentioned that I hated my mom and I hated me. I was filled with hatred really for everyone. I was violent and I used to attack my mom, and she was sober at that point and she didn't think she had to be subjected to attacks anymore in sobriety, and she asked me to leave and I did. I had been asked not to contact any other members of my family. And I didn't bother trying. I had been in a number of foster homes and thrown out of all of them. I tried to get into drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes in the L.A. area. There weren't that many of them, but none of them would take me, some because of my age and some because of my attitude. There was a program back then some of you may have heard of, and it was called Synanon, and they were actually desperate for membership, and they wouldn't take me either. So things were really looking pretty bad in those few weeks before I came in, and I thought, well, you know, I don't really care about that, because really if you're a tough gang member, the only thing that's important is, you know, your gang. I mean, that's all that really matters. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all 5 members of my own gang beat me up, you know. So by the time I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a black eye, I had a swollen lip, I had no shoes, I had no family that wanted anything to do with me, I had no place to live. And, you know, I was just started raising my hand in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it was really kind of simple. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? You know, it was just, that was it. And I, you know, I went to 21 meetings a week the first couple of years that I was sober, and I had a commitment at almost every one of those meetings. And it wasn't that I wanted to get a gold star in AA. I was just terrified. And I had no place else to go, you know. It's just, you know, and my home group, you know, the Monday Night Venice group, they put me in charge of the literature, you know, and that was my commitment. And I never missed that Monday night meeting. I mean, you know, I remember one time I was a couple months sober and I went to the meeting and I had these really sore lumps behind my ears. And so I went to the meeting, and I went, you know, and I had the different old timers at the meeting feeling the lumps. It never would have occurred to me to go to a doctor because, you know, you just go to your home group. And I felt the lumps, and, you know, the lumps got bigger and bigger over the next couple of days, and it turned out I had the mumps, you know, but then they told me it was really serious to expose people, you know, to that. And so I had to get the list from the home group and call everybody and kind of make amends, you know, but I never missed a meeting, you know. I mean, I had to go, you know. My home group at Monday Night Venice, they'd say it's very important that you get the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't have the big book, we'll sell it to you. We'll make credit arrangements, anything you need, you know. And if you're too afraid to talk to us, you can just go ahead and steal it. Well, I'd been stealing longer than I'd been drinking. And I felt that those were unrelated activities. So I did not stop stealing just because I was getting sober. But I did have this superstition that perhaps stealing a big book from AA would jinx your sobriety or something. So I went to the library, and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And while I was there, I stole a copy of the 12 and 12 because a lot of people were talking about that book, too. I thought it must be a good one. And I was sober a while. And I realized I had to make amends, you know, so I took those books along with, you know, 20 others. I had great classics like Misty the Seahorse. I'd been a library book stealer from way back. And this was not an easy thing, you know, for a tough Venice broad to do, to walk in and say, you know, I steal library books. But I knew it was important to my sobriety, so I went in and I gave them back to the librarian and I said, you know, returning these books, I'd like to make payments, though, because, you know, they want 3 to 5 cents a day, and I'd had some of the books for, you know, for several years. And she said, you know, that's the funniest thing. She said, I used to work at this library in Laguna Beach, and this man, you know, he came in and he'd stolen the big book. She goes, I guess you guys do this all the time. So it was another one of those times where I realized I wasn't unique, you know. You know, when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that this won't surprise you, but just in case, I'll go ahead and mention that I had a bad attitude. I didn't like women. I didn't like any women. I didn't like me. I didn't like my mother. I figured any other women around here were alcoholic women, and I didn't like them. I didn't like sitting next to women. I did not shake hands with women. I most assuredly did not hug women, and I did not like listening to women speakers, which always makes me feel better because I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like. The only men I had really known in my life were alcoholics, and most of them were extremely violent. I figured everybody here, you know, the guys, they were alcoholics. They were probably violent. They scared me. I didn't want anything to do with them either. And so I had a problem because in July of 1972, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, all they had were men and women, and I didn't like any of them, you know. But I went to these 21 meetings a week anyway, and I did not get rides. I didn't ask for rides, and there weren't a lot of people that really wanted to give me them. I had a very limited vocabulary when I came to the program. Consisted almost solely of profanity. There were a few exceptions, the and mother. And I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and my ankles. I was barefoot most of the first couple of years. I had a motorcycle jacket that on the back said, do unto others and then split. It was my own little spiritual motto. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day when I came to the program. I lit all of them myself. Occasionally someone would hold a match. I let them hold it as long as they liked, but they never lit my cigarette with it. And after I'd been sober a short period of time, I took up smoking cigars and then a pipe. I can remember I would stand at the Tuesday night Westwood 2+2 meeting, and I was the greeter. And I can remember standing at the door, barefoot, with my motorcycle chains and cigar, and my black eye, welcoming the newcomers as they came to AA. And I'd hear their sponsors sort of whisper sometimes as they walk by, you see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that, you know. When I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, people were guessing my age at 37. I was 13. I'm 47 tonight. And I I'm sure that I'm going to deal with some aging issues because everybody does. But I got to tell you, I still feel at least 1,000 years younger than I did when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I don't know when it's all going to catch up, you know, but I was so old when I came to AA. And I didn't, you know, there was so much hope here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, I think it's so fascinating because all I took of the hope, you know, was I just took a little bit of it, you know, because I didn't think it could all happen. You know, it just couldn't, you know, for someone like me. But I can remember, you know, I was so lucky, you know, I'd get to go to these meetings and I'd hear Chuck Spee and, you know, and just so many amazing Marion Chapman, you know, about where your sobriety. You know, I had the privilege of hearing Sybil Corwin. She had 32 years in my first 30 days, you know, the first woman sober west of the Mississippi, you know, and I'd hear her at these meetings, and these were powerful people. And they just gave you a lot of hope. You know, they came from incredible places and they'd experienced incredible things. And, you know, I would sit there and I would hear some of them and they'd say, you know, today I can walk down the sunny side of the street. You know, I can look people in the eye. I'm one of God's kids. I'm just as good as anybody else, you know. And I'd think, oh, that's not going to happen for me. But I thought, you know, if I go to lots and lots of meetings and I try this really, really hard, maybe one day when I'm walking down the street and I happen to look at myself in one of those storefront windows, which is about the only place that I was planning on looking at myself, and I happen to catch a glance, maybe I won't feel like throwing up at what I see looking back. And that was enough hope for me to keep coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated everything about myself. I always had. And that did not miraculously go away when I took a 30-day chip. You know, it was funny. I was thinking today, I've thought this a number of times. I thought if there's a fault, if we want to call it that, or a criticism, I don't think that's the right word. You know what I mean? But if there's a little problem with AA, the reason that I think that we lose so many members, in my opinion, you know, is that it's so slow. I heard this announcement, you know, somebody was telling me about this, and I don't remember where it was, you know, but they were telling me, they go, you know, there's this treatment center, and it promises you the equivalent of a year of sobriety in 30 days. And I thought, ah, isn't that what everybody wants? You know, I mean, wow. I mean, I think they're probably full, you know. Equivalent of, you know, because I don't want to do the work and do the, you know what I mean? It's like, I just thought it should happen so fast. And it seemed like it was happening fast to everyone else around me. It did seem like everybody else took their 30-day chip and, you know, they got invited to Christmas dinner and checks started coming in the mail, you know, job offers, you know, I mean, things like that. And as I've mentioned to you, you know, I was over 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I could even put a dollar in the basket. I mean, I was just very slow. But, you know, one of the things that happened for me is that, you know, I can remember, I'll tell you a couple of little stories and then we'll see where I go from there. I went to a convention, thinking about this because Chuck is here, so I think he's one of the only people that probably saw me, maybe shipwrecked, but Chuck for sure in my first year of sobriety. I went to a convention, my home group, you know, we all piled in the car, and we went to the San Francisco International Young People's Convention. And I had been to conventions by then because I was in a very active group. And I'd been to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went to this convention, and so, you know, we piled in the car and drove to San Francisco, which was very far. I had never been, I'd run away once from Venice. I'd made it 3 miles east to Culver City. So I really wasn't a geographic, you know, kind of a person. So San Francisco is about 8 hours drive. So we drove to San Francisco, and we were going to go stay at a hotel. Now, I grew up living in hotels. Many hotels, you know, with my mom. So, I mean, I know hotels. But we pulled up at this convention, we pulled up at the St. Francis Hotel. Now, I don't know if a lot of you have been there. I can only tell you the way I remember it in 1973. This was not the kind of hotel. I had never seen anything like this. You know, like red velvet drapes, you know, floor to the ceiling, huge, you know, all this stuff. Women in gowns in the daytime, you know, inside. And I could not believe that this is where they were going to have a convention. And I wouldn't go in for a while Because I knew, you know, if I walked in there, I mean, they're going to come over and they're going to say, excuse me, you're from Venice, right? I mean, can you tell this is a nice place? You know, you can't stay here, you know. And I didn't want to embarrass my home group. You know, I didn't want to embarrass everybody. And I finally kind of snuck into the room. It's the only convention of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever been to. I never went to one meeting. I just knew they were going to find me and, you know, throw me out. I actually went out and went walking around on Skid Row, and I just felt so comfortable. It was like, oh, my gosh, this is great. You know, but that's the only part of San Francisco I saw, the St. Francis and Skid Row, and I couldn't stay at the St. Francis, you know, and I was almost a year sober. And, you know, I just, you know, I tried to do the things that were asked of me, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor. I got active. And I began to try and work the steps, you know, to the best of my ability and to learn to show up one day at a time for things that were going on. And I found myself, I think I was 5 years sober, something like that. I'm not sure. I was at the Palm Springs Roundup, and they had a big fancy banquet on Saturday night. And I was sitting at the banquet, and I was at a table about this size. You know, we had all these round tables. And I remember sitting around the room comparing myself to everyone else in the room, something I still do if I want to really feel bad. But anyway, I was doing that. I was looking around the room, and I saw, you know, somebody in a black dress. And I go, wow, that is gorgeous. I thought, don't you wish you were wearing that black dress? And I thought, no, I talked to myself. I don't know if you guys do, but I talked to myself. I thought, no, you know, I'm glad I'm wearing this brown dress. I thought, are you kidding? I go, okay, wait a minute. I go, green is your absolute favorite color. I mean, look around there. I mean, you see that green dress over there? Isn't that not one of the most beautiful things you've ever seen? I go, yeah, really beautiful. Don't you wish you were wearing the green dress? And I thought, no, I'm really glad I'm wearing this brown dress. And I kind of looked around. I mean, you know, I didn't want to be sitting at the fun table, you know. I didn't wish I had your mother. I didn't wish I was from your hometown. I mean, I didn't even want to be blonde or stacked or anything. And all that is like pretty incredible, given that all my life I wanted to be anyone but me. But the most amazing thing was I realized for the very first time in my life that I can ever remember, before drinking, during drinking, or after drinking, as I sat there right then, I wanted to feel like I was feeling. I tell you that there were incredibly persuasive members of Alcoholics Anonymous here when I came in, but there is not one or all of them put together that could have told me that someday that was going to happen for me. And I don't know exactly how it happened, and I think it would make a much better talk if I could tell you that from that moment to this, it's always been that way, but that's not true. You know, I haven't always been that comfortable, you know, in my own skin. But I remember hearing Sybil at that meeting, you know, when I was about 30 days sober. And I remember her saying, you know, she said, you know, here she is. She's got 32 years. She's got this amazing life going on, you know. She says, you know, if I could take it, newcomers, and I could give you everything that I've got and just give it to you, she said, I wouldn't do it. And I thought, how mean. I mean, I know she can't do it, but that's just mean, you know. If she could, I mean, why not, you know. And she said, because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. And I sure didn't understand it then. But wow. You know, I mean, it's just been unbelievable. It says in the book, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. And I have no idea where the halfway point is. But I got to tell you, I'm amazed. You know, and I suppose when I think about it, you know, it seems to me that the very first good thought I ever had about me in my whole life was I thought, you know, you're a pretty good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the first thing I ever liked about June. And I'll tell you, I think sometimes, you know, that my service in Alcoholics Anonymous and the things that I have learned to do here have had the effect, I think, of maybe what some people get or try to get, you know, from having like plastic surgery or something, you know what I mean? Because I don't feel the way that I used to feel. I don't look the way that I used to look. I don't live the way that I used to live, you know? And I'm so grateful for that. You know, there used to be people around in the early days of my sobriety. I suppose there are now, you know, and they'd say, you know, I was a drunken SOB, and today I'm a sober SOB. You know, I do the same thing I did when I was drinking that I do sober, you know. And that's fine for them. There will always be people like that in Alcoholics Anonymous, but that can't work for me. I can't live the way that I used to live. I came in the program with a seventh grade education. I had dropped out of school, and I had a sponsor, and my sponsor told me that I should try and go back to school, and I did a little bit, but you can imagine how I didn't quite fit in at the local junior high, and it didn't work, and I tried high school later, and that didn't work either. You know, I hated everything about myself, and I just did not fit in. I was 1,000 years older than those people. It just couldn't work, you know. So instead, I went to lots and lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsor told me I'd have to get the kind of jobs that you get when you have a seventh grade education, and that's what I did. And they were jobs that allowed me a lot of flexibility so that I could get to lots and lots of meetings, you know, of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after I'd been sober for a while, sort of like I think what Dick was sharing about, I had once been able to read. I mean, I stole library books, you know, but in my sobriety, my brain did not work anymore for a long time afterwards, you know, and my body had a lot of physical problems as well. So I had just done a lot of damage. And after I was sober a couple years, I heard about this class that they called a dummy. They called it that. They called it a dummy English class over at this little city college. And I went ahead and I signed up to take this class, hoping that maybe I could read and kind of hold three or four sentences in my head again. And then I also, you know, I took another class, and then I finished those classes. And then I continued, and I took a few other classes, and then I learned about taking a GED. And I just kind of kept showing up, and I got active in general service about that time. And it was funny, I was telling Helen, you know, I think I was telling Helen, but or Bob, I guess, too, but I got elected the treasurer of the Southern California Assembly area. And there are several thousand meetings in that area. And your job as the treasurer, you know, is they're going to mail you checks, you know, to support the general service office. Well, I couldn't even balance a checkbook. You know, I don't know, you know, how I got this job, but the first time I mailed everybody their checks back with the receipt, you know, and I had to stand up in front of the general service assembly and ask them to send me back the checks. And because of that, this guy named John Edwards came up to me after that, and he offered, he had been an accountant, and John asked if him and his wife, Helen, could help me learn how to be a better treasurer, and they became some of my dearest friends, and they live here in Plantation, Florida, and I've been able to you know, help give them a party for their 50th wedding anniversary and their 60th wedding anniversary. And I was able to come here this January and share their 63rd anniversary. And then about a month ago, Helen passed away. And I got to visit John a couple of days before I came up here. And I get to go back and see him. And he's taught me so much about service in Alcoholics Anonymous and so changed my life, you know. And anyway, where am I going to go with that? Well, I kept going to school and kept taking some different classes. And eventually they called me in and they told me that I had completed the requirements for an AA degree, which I thought was a nice name for a college degree. I'd never planned on getting a college degree, but I kind of liked the name. And then they called me back in and they you know, told me I had to do some footwork to go ahead and go on to college if that's what I wanted to do. And I did that footwork, and I was accepted at a university, and I went ahead and I continued, you know, to go on to school. And I think that, you know, I was very lucky because I had a sponsor who was very practical. She was spiritual, but she was also a very practical person. And she told me that I had to do the same footwork in Alcoholics Anonymous that any person in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous had to do to make dreams come true. And I went ahead and I filled out these applications and I tried to do this basic footwork, and I got a telegram when I applied to graduate school. And, you know, I think kind of before I sort of tell you about that, I should tell you about my first sponsor. You know, my first sponsor was a woman named Gail Wilson. And Gail became my sponsor, and I verified this, you know. because she was taught to never say no to an AA request. And, you know, I would go to these 21 meetings a week. It seemed as though a woman named Gail spoke at about 18 of them every week. You know, it was just making me crazy. And I thought, perhaps if I ask this woman to be my sponsor, which is the only reason I think of asking a woman to be my sponsor, I could find out ahead of time where she's speaking, and then I won't have to hear her all the time. So, you know, anyway, I asked her to be my sponsor. And, you know, Gail and I are exactly what I think about when they say we are people who normally would not mix. Gail was three times my age. She was from the South. She was from a warm, loving, very close family. She had traveled all over the world. She was a stewardess. She was very well educated. You know, she was Southern, you know, so she had that Southern thing. And, you know, and not only did Gail not use the same words I was using, she didn't know what a lot of the words I was using meant, you know. And I would see her at the Brentwood group, which was her home group at the time, and I'd go over and say hi, and she'd say, "Now look, June," she'd say, "don't sit next to me at the meeting." She said, "I can't take the cigar smoke." And she said, "And not only that, please don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor," you know. And that was fine with me, because I didn't really want people to know I was hanging out with someone like her, you know, because she was very lame. And I mean, as if all those other things I've told you were not bad enough, she had been seen in public on numerous occasions wearing pink, which was really pretty unforgivable as far as I was concerned, you know. And anyway, and Gail was to become my sponsor, and she taught me a lot of stuff, and so she told me that I had to do this footwork, and I did do this footwork, and I got a telegram, and it's been quite a while ago now, telling me that I'd been chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. And I'll tell you, I had always... I had always planned on spending a lot of time in court. but never on that side of the table. And I was able to go on to law school and show up and try and put these principles in my life one day at a time and try and do the best I could. And it was very hard for me. And it's interesting because, you know, about this time, Gail was sponsoring a woman named Linda. And Linda is and was one of the most incredibly physically beautiful women you have ever seen in your life. It's just, it's really unbelievable, you know. And Gail started to sponsor her maybe a little bit before I went to law school. And Gail thought I should become her friend. Now, I hadn't had, you know, like two dates in a row. You know what I mean? You don't want to hang out with someone like that looks like Linda if you're ever hoping to get another date, you know, for one thing. And besides that, you know, Linda was from Santa Barbara. And she came from a worn, loving family, you know, rather wealthy. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, I mean, she was probably alcoholic, you know, but she wasn't a real alcoholic, you know, like the streets of Venice, you know, alcoholic. And Gail, you know, would just say, you know, "I want you to be her friend." It's like she doesn't need friends. You know, I mean, look at her. You know, somebody who looks like that, they don't need friends, you know, and I don't think so, you know. I mean, can't she get another sponsor? And, you know, that was my thought. But anyway, you know, we had this. And finally, Gail got so mad at me. And she said, "Did it ever occur to you that you have to have exactly the same feeling to try and kill yourself in an alley in Venice as you do in a hotel room in Paris?" No. No, it never really did occur to me, you know. And, you know, it was such an interesting concept to me, you know. But, I mean, it was like I started to realize then when Linda became my friend because Gail made me, you know, that Linda was one of God's kids, you know, and that it really doesn't matter where we come from, you know. And it was just such a... It has been such an amazing, special friendship in my life. And I'm so grateful, you know, that Gail taught me about that. And it has been something that has taught me so much in life. I mean, you know, this weekend you're going to see me and I'm going to be hanging around with two of the most beautiful blondes in this room, you know, all weekend long, you know. And when I got married, I had these three amazing, beautiful women. You know, my kids were like looking at the pictures. They're like, Mom, these women are like gorgeous. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess so, you know. You know, but I mean, it's like I love them on the inside. So, you know, and it's kind of like, you know, I feel better looking than I am. So it doesn't really matter. You know, I mean, it's like it works. I think, not too long before I was scheduled to graduate from law school, it became very clear that my sponsor, Gail Wilson, at 48 years old, was dying of cancer. And I spent a lot of time in the hospital room with her when she was dying. And that's where I kind of confirmed the whole idea that she said yes, because she couldn't say no to an AA request. And she said, you know, June, when you asked me to be your sponsor, she said, you know, I knew you were not going to make it. She said, I knew that someone with your background and your attitude was just never going to stay. She said, but I said, yes, because that's what I've been taught to do. And she said, and then I remember, you know, you were such a flake. She said, it was really unbelievable, you know, I mean, how bad it was. And it really was. We can't go into all of it, really. But, you know, it was slow for me. She said, but, you know, she was just unbelievable. She said, and then I remember you called me up a couple years ago and you said, I'm going to take a class at this city college, Gail. And she said, I knew you'd never finish. You hadn't finished anything. You know, you couldn't keep a job for 30 days. I mean, you were just awful, you know. And she said, but I didn't say anything. And she said, and then you took a couple more classes. And I remember you called me up and you said, Gail, I think I know what I want to do, Gail. I think I want to go be a lawyer. She said, I had to force myself not to laugh out loud. She said, you know, she said, I knew you weren't going to be able to do that. You haven't even graduated high school, you know. She said, but you didn't say anything. And that's what we talked about. I go, you know, why didn't you say anything? And she said, you know, even though Gail never believed in June, ever, she always believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen unbelievable things happen here, things that really shouldn't really be able to happen, it seems like, you know. And yet they had happened in her life, and they have happened in mine, and they've happened in most of the people's lives that I have, you know, walked on this journey with. And they're all different, our journey. You know, not everybody goes to law school, thank goodness. You know, but anyway, I'll tell you this part. I graduated law school, and Gail had passed away a few months before that. And in order to be a lawyer, you have to take a test. It's a 3-day test. It's 8 hours a day, you know, and you take this test, and then you wait 6 months to get your bar results to find out whether you are actually allowed to practice law. And so I took that test and I studied really, really hard and I showed up and I did the very best I could and I kept all my AA commitments and I prayed and I tried to keep a good spiritual, you know, close contact with my higher power, and I just tried to do all the right things. And I took, you know, the 3-day test, showed up, did all that, whatever. And then I got the results in November of 1983, and I got a letter and it said I did not pass and I would not be allowed to be a lawyer. And I couldn't believe it. I was 11 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had enough money to pay my rent on December 1st. And that was it. I didn't have a dollar to put in the basket. I didn't have any money to put gas in my car. I was supposed to speak, and I didn't know, you know, I had to speak the night I got that letter. And, oh, I just really wanted to run right out there, you know. And I called my best friend, Mike. And I called Mike and I told him. And he met me at the meeting. And I stood up there and I think cried for 45 minutes. I have no idea. You know, I was just told to show up. And then we went to the coffee shop and we talked. And I showed Mike the telegram. And, you know, it was one of those nights, you know, I know that if you have a sponsor, you've had conversations like the one I had with Mike that night. But I showed him this telegram, and I said, you know, do you see this, Mike? I didn't pass. I said, you know what? I have enough money to pay my rent on December 1st. That's it. You know, I don't have any other money. I'm 11 years sober. You know, aren't I supposed to be able to take a newcomer out and buy their coffee by now? You know, I mean, what was I thinking? You know, I mean, this was just ridiculous. I mean, I'm from Venice. You know, I mean, this is crazy. This is not God's will. That's what this letter says. You know, that was stupid. This is not God's will. Go be a waitress. You're good at that. You'll be fine. And Mike said, well, let me see the telegram. And he looked at it for a minute. And he goes, no, I think it says you should take the test again. I go, no. You know, it's like when you're talking to your sponsor and you tell them, you go, what time is it? And they go, it's a horse. This is not helping. You know, you're not getting it. You know, and I said, I don't have any money. And he goes, well, you know, I said, I owe a lot of money, Mike. I borrowed money to go to school. I have to pay it back. He goes, well, borrow some more. You know, so I did. Around that time, I got a 12-step call, borrowed some money so I could go pick her up. We took her to a meeting, and we came back to my apartment, and we're sitting there, and she's crying and kind of getting sober. And she said, I only have enough money for my rent. I don't have any other money. And I go, well, you know, neither do I. She goes, I don't have a job. I go, well, neither do I. And she's like, how long have you been sober? 11 years. It's a good program. Really. Most people are doing better than this. You know, keep coming back. You know, just like, geez, you know. Anyway, I was on to take the test again, and I did pass. And then I was allowed to get a job that I still have today. And it was a job that allows me to, I believe, be of service. And I feel very, very grateful. In fact, I've been working at that job for quite a while. And after I'd been there for about, I think, 5 years, you know, they call me in and they asked me if I would work in training the new lawyers. Because they said that they really liked my attitude. And I thought, boy, in 1972, nobody ever thought I'd get a job for my attitude, you know. I'm going to tell you about one other thing, I guess, and then I'm going to sit down. I mentioned that, you know, I'd had a lot of physical problems, and I did. And I had a lot of surgeries, and a lot of problems, and I was told by the time I was 15 that I needed to have a hysterectomy because I just had so much damage and there just wasn't any way that they could help me with the problems that I was having, but that no one would do it until I turned 18. No doctor would do it in the United States. And actually my sponsors, you know, we actually talked about whether I should go to Mexico or something and try and get, you know, that operation. But I didn't. I didn't have the money. We didn't know whether it was the right thing. I mean, you know, whatever. But it was really hard having those, you know, health problems and stuff. But I learned to just show up and do the best I could. And I never wanted to have a kid, for sure. Never wanted to, because I had hated everything about my life, my childhood, who I was. And I wouldn't want to pass on anything, even remotely, that could have been like a June to anybody, you know. And yet, you know, later on in my sobriety, you know, I got married in 1988, and when I got married, every member of my family came, and two members came from another country that had never been in this country to represent both of my grandparents, and it was such a healing, you know, that had happened in my family, because I was over 5 years sober before I got invited for a Christmas with my family. You know, it was slow for me. Anyway, I had a miscarriage in 1991, and then I got pregnant and I had a little girl, and I had a really hard time, you know, with the miscarriage and getting pregnant and, you know, whatever, and I had some fertility help, and, you know, it was just this thing, and then, like, 6 months later, I had really bad flu. It was just awful, and so I went back to the doctor, you know, from the flu. And she told me that I was pregnant, which I was sure was not possible, but I was. And so they told me I was having what they call Irish twins, you know, when you have them that close together. And so I had another daughter. And then a few years later, I had another daughter. And I have three daughters, and they'll be at the ice cream social. They don't want me to talk too long because they want to get in line for ice cream, you know. And I'll tell you, you know, one of my daughters in particular, people will say things, you know, to me often about, you know, how she looks a lot like me. And I think, you know, in the early years of my sobriety, I think I might have wanted to slug someone if they had said something like that, you know. And today, you know, I think, Yeah, you know, she's really cute. She didn't get curly hair, but she's doing pretty good without that. But, you know, I just, you know, it's such an amazing thing. You know, my second daughter, both my two daughters are going to high school. You know, that's more education than I did. You know, when my firstborn daughter, Sammy, was 5, they gave us this little form that you fill out for, like, your memory book for school. And it's like, you know, what's your favorite color? What's your favorite book? What's your favorite TV show? You know, we fill this out together. And then it says, you know, what's the best thing that ever happened to you? And she said, you know, I went to Disneyland. So what's the worst thing that ever happened to you? She said, I got a boo-boo. And I thought, and I think about that so much. You know, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I come from a place, the streets where I come from in Venice, and the women that I drank and used with. You know, there's never a time where you're living there where the gas, the phone, and the lights are all on at the same time. You know, the women that I drank with are either dead, locked up in some kind of an institution, or they're out on the streets turning tricks so that they can survive the habit that they have. And a number of them have had kids, you know, that were born addicted to the different drugs that they use, you know? And that's where people like me, because I'm an alcoholic, that's what happens to people like me, you know? And because I found a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I have been given an amazing life, one that I never would have wanted. And as I said in the beginning, I'm a person I wouldn't have even liked when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet, you know, there was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous named Norm Alpie when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the most important speakers in my life I ever heard. Every time I heard Norm Alpie talk, I thought, I want to join AA. And then I'd remember I already belonged, or I wouldn't have been there hearing him. But he was just phenomenal. And one of the things that Norm always said when he was closing was he'd say, you know, but for the grace of God, rooms like this, people like you, I could have missed it all. Thanks for not letting me.